Okay, who is going to ask the first question today?
Hey, Annie, this is Ed Eccleston. How are you?
Hey, Ed, long time.
I know, long time no talk. Hope all is well.
Yep. Okay. Go ahead.
Hey, so I attended an ST downtime council back in May. Where I guess Axway was in the beginning stages of designing, you know, how that would actually work with an enterprise cluster. I was curious if there's been any progress made on that front. Zero downtime is a very hot topic here at Dell. And, you know, we have an enterprise cluster environment that we're wanting to, you know, when we do patches or updates or things along those nature, things along that, those lines, right? We want to do so with zero downtime if possible. So I was just curious where we are on the Axway side of things as it comes to that.
Not yet. So they are working on it. We don't even have the reference architecture of what you will need to do in order for it to work in your environment. But as long as there are any news, believe me, I probably will be opening this meeting with them. But it's too early for that. They're in very early stages. As I said, we don't even have reference environments yet. We have our customer zero in our cloud environment, obviously. We're not there yet. But that's the goal. The idea will be to allow you to do all the patching and requirements without actually losing anything and without shutting down everything. What we know so far is that it won't be as easy as a rolling update. But that's pretty much all we had been told. So getting there. I'm just coming from summit. We had our summit last week. And they're a little further away compared to where they were back in May. But still, it's not fully built yet. They're still designing pieces of it. So it won't be soon. If it is something that is blocking your updates this year, I wouldn't count on it. I don't have dates. Don't get me wrong. They might surprise all of us by it. But I wouldn't think that we will have it this year yet. Not for GA. So.
Okay.
But it's coming. That's what we're all told. So.
Right. Okay.
And for anyone that's listening, that will be enterprise cluster only. This will never show up for standard cluster for various reasons. So, okay.
And just a follow up on that. If you don't mind. So the other thing is with the database itself, right? So. I'm wondering if we're going to get to a point as well where we can do an automated database failover without interrupting the application, right? So we use Oracle external database. We use Oracle. They have this fast start failover option. So I think you know where I'm getting at.
Nothing on the map at the moment. However, it's possible that as a side effect of what they're doing to that zero downtime, we might be getting better at that. The current way it works is that we cannot tolerate losing the database. If whatever technology you're using, for example, Oracle Rack can swap databases behind the scenes without us even realizing it's happening on a single scan address. This is still working. It had always worked. It might be a little hinky sometimes, as we all know, if the Oracle doesn't read very cleanly. But that kind of setup had always worked because for us, it's the same database and we don't, it appears almost like just small timeouts here and there. So we can't, that we can tolerate. But the way the software is written is that we use the database as configuration engine, especially the coherence layer on top of it. So the second we lose the database, we're kind of dead in the water. So the daemons start misbehaving. And I haven't seen anything. Now, they are also working on something different, which will be the cloud edition of ST, which will be a very different ball game that will be running in container, in clouds, and so on. And those will be able to tolerate things a little better. But that's a different conversation altogether. And this is even further down the road.
Okay.
So, but yeah, we're working on things like that. We know that we overly rely on both the file system and on the database. But on the other hand, I mean, if we don't have access to the data, what can we do? And it's right. Not that easy to switch as many threads and as many pools as we have running all the time. So, plus,
okay.
There is the secondary concern here. When you're switching to a different database, how behind is that second database? Remember that we have the events table. We basically are controlled by a table in the database. And if you switch to a place where the events table is even 5 seconds behind, you'll start resending the same files and funny stuff like that. So that's some of the challenges that they are looking into. But yeah, I know exactly why you're asking, and you need the perfect zero downtime. No matter what happens, you never go down, right? We are working right. on it, but let's
yeah,
be honest.
We don't ever want to be down, Annie. You know this one.
You and everyone else on the phone. Unfortunately, and I'll be very honest, no matter what we built and how we built it, outages will always happen. You know, right. You cannot predict everything.
Sure.
We're trying to minimize it. We're getting close. But how close, we shall see. So, okay. Yeah.
Hey, Annie, in that session last week, they talked about replicating the database then pointing, you know, swapping out in a two-node cluster, if you will, you know, just pointing. And so you had one server down for patching while the other one was up and pointed at the replicated. It still was a little confusing in the sense that 5 second delay you were talking about, that kind of, you can drop a transfer
always,
right
yeah.
then.
You will always have that no matter what.
Okay.
We're getting too close. So because of the way the event table is written, because of how we handle it, dropping events will be a lot less likely than actually picking up the same one twice and controlling that in case your replication is a little slow or a little old. So there will always be a point over there that you might be able to roll through it, but you'll need to look into it. And that part of the challenges of what they're trying to solve. But it's an MFT system where, depending on your system, you might be moving thousands of files per hour or more in some cases. You know, not disrupting will not be trivial. So, we shall see. Okay. What do we have next? It's a very silent meeting. While everyone is thinking on questions, had you seen the new ST and seen the new UIs you are having? In case this looks unfamiliar, that's the May release of ST actually. Oh.
Hi.
Hey.
Annie.
Yep.
Good morning. I have a question related to the database. So, do you suggest any specific database, example, MS SQL or Oracle?
Whatever your DBAs are more comfortable with. So
I have I have DBS for both. I mean,
well, what OS are you running on? Are your ST servers on Linux or on Windows?
Linux.
Linux. I am partial to Oracle simply because it's our oldest and we have the most experience with working with it. And I personally have the most experience with Oracle. MS SQL, as long as you have a good admin team and as long as they are not trying to cut corners on resources, can work as well. Postgre, our new kit on the block, let's say it like that, can also handle similar loads. So it really will come down to looking at what exactly you're doing. And unless you're trying to run something like a million files per hour or something, the database, as long as it's properly sized, will not really make much of a difference. So it really comes down to what your environment is more comfortable with.
Yeah, right now we use Oracle Large Enterprise Cluster on-prem, but we are moving to cloud. So I think there is an issue with rack support. So I was just thinking about because I mean whether we can switch to the MS SQL. So that's the reason I'm asking this question. So
you can. The good news is that when you bring in the accounts, the XML export is database agnostic.
Yeah.
So it doesn't care where you started originally, but we use both databases as the same way, more or less. And even if underlying schema is different, it can be different. If we're talking about going to cloud, are you thinking about RDS or setting up your own databases?
Sorry, what is that first one?
Sorry. Are you going to use the database as a service from the cloud team, or is your team going to set up real databases in the cloud?
Yeah, our own database.
Okay. Well, up to you. It depends. I cannot tell you what will run better in the cloud. We have both. So it's literally, if you're asking me Linux or Windows, I have a very strong preference. When we're talking about databases, it's just a preference just because I know Oracle better. But I also know it's very expensive and sometimes, especially in the cloud, is not getting situated properly. So if you decide to switch, I would strongly recommend some performance testing before you go live, because the parameters you will need to be adjusted, especially if you have high volume.
Okay.
It gets tuned a little differently from Oracle in terms of threads and so on, because, you know, underlying technology is different.
Okay.
The other thing is, as you know, all know or don't know or haven't realized, we actually switched to Open Coherence. We're not using the Oracle Coherence anymore. Which kind of sort of eliminated one of the reasons to go to Oracle for a lot of people. So, but again, as I said, if you ask me, I always prefer Oracle. Again, pure personal preference. Our reference environments these days are with Postgre. So, up to you. And we have quite a lot of customers on MS SQL by this time. It's not new. So if you need to switch to that, that's okay. We have the information. So, and I know you are looking for a yes/no answer and a little bit stronger worded one, but that's literally one of the cases where we can spend the whole conversation talking about what people prefer. And that's why my answer is whoever is going to manage your databases feels more comfortable with. So, make sense?
Okay.
Yeah. One thing, if you need to choose, I would go with whatever you can get a bigger database in. If one of them will be a shared resource or if one of them will have restrictions on size or CPU, you know, I would go with the other one. Just general principle. You know, give it more power, the better. That's the only thing I would look at if your admins are okay with both.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Of course. Okay. What else do we have?
Hi, Annie. Joe here. Joe Hawk.
Hey, Joe.
Hi. On that zero downtime, Postgres, could we use that database instead of SQL Server or Oracle?
It should work for all of the databases we have in the enterprise cluster. Again, should being the operative word for now. It's too early, Joe.
I hear it's you.
In. I hear you. But yeah. Again, our customer zero is our cloud, and our cloud has been switching to Postgres in some environments. So I believe it will be for all of the databases, and that's what we had been told. The mechanisms behind the scenes might be a little different, but that's the story at the moment.
Sure, sure. And so we'll see how that progresses. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, yes. Thank you.
And if someone is interested in being an early adopter or early beta tester or whatever, I believe they'll be opening the conversation for people sooner or later. They already are talking to some. Axway had changed the way we're doing things. Back in the days, we'll just build something and drop it and tell people go use it. These days, we ask a lot more questions early on. So there is that.
So. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What is next?
So I have a quick question. My name is Carmen Burns, and I'm kind of I've been using Axway, but not all the time. And so I wondered if you create like a new account and you attach a GID, a GID to it, but then you remove the GID and you put in another one. Is there any way that you could delete anything that's existing in the database for other accounts?
Okay, let's unpack that because I know where you're going. You're asking if we use the GID of someone else, can you get to someone else's files on the file system? That's what you're asking, right?
Well, I mean, what I'm asking is that there's... You have all these accounts, right? And I'm supposed to go in and create a new account. So I do, and so I add an existing GID, but realize, oh, okay, that's the wrong one. So I remove it from this new account, and I get the right GID and add it. And so then in adding it, it's working right, but then the GID that I just removed gets deleted from the database and it's associated with an account and it disappears. Is that possible or what? I mean, I've been...
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let me drop on the server because when you say GID, you mean literally the value over here, right? Hold on. Let me... You mean this value here, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. So when you change it for a certain account, all it does, if your non-root account, if your non-root install, if you're installed under a service account, ST, it doesn't change absolutely anything, except that some access rules might be tied to it and so on. But from the file system perspective, nothing changes. If you are root install, then what it will do when you change it, it will ask you if you want to change the permissions on the file system. And if you say yes, it will change them and so on, but that's about it. It will not change anything for any other account at all. There is one exception. If your accounts are sharing their home folders, or if you have nested home folders, where, for example, the supervisor is in user data, supervisor, and then everyone is under it. So, you know, when you have nested folders, and if you change the GID on the top folder, it will change for everyone because they're under him.
Oh.
Besides that, whenever you change this UID GID here, it will only change things inside of the home folder, which is listed under it. That's all. It doesn't change anything in the database. It doesn't change anything on the file system outside of this folder. And when you change it, let me see if I can do that to show you actually. I don't remember if this server will give me that, but when you try to save it, I'm non-root. If I was root, it will actually ask me at this point, you're changing the UID or GID. Do you want to change the file system as well? And do you want to do it recursively? There is a little pop-up now that will ask you what you want to do. If you're on the newest versions, the last few versions, on the previous one, it was doing it behind the scenes for you. So on the updates before February, maybe, it will just change it for you. So if you see changes in other accounts, then the only explanation for me might be that the other account actually had a nested folder. And there is one more option, and it might be just a user thing. ST is not tab friendly. So if you open one account to look into it, and then open a second tab to open a second account, and you go to save the first one, it will actually save the second account with the data of the first one, thus eliminating one account. So maybe, I don't know what happened to bring your question, but you be careful with that. They're actually, as you saw the first page on the 5.5 on the May release, they wrote the whole page. They're actually writing the whole application to make it a little bit more user-friendly, but it takes a while. But if you can tell me more about what happened to bring the question, we can go bottom to the bottom of what happened. But other from that, the answer is changing the UID GID of a single account does not change anything for other accounts unless they're nested under him.
Okay.
And of course, yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
I said that could have been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess in going further, not much more complicated than what I explained.
And UID GID is not on the business unit level anywhere. It's just on the account level. So again, if something changed elsewhere, it's one of those things. Either you had two browser windows open, so you saved the wrong on top of it because it saves the last position regardless of where you are. Mm-hmm. Or, as I said, you had nested somewhere. So that one changed to another. If something else happened, it's a bug, but I cannot imagine how. Now, if you had been changing home folders and step on someone else's folder, that's what happened there, right? But just with GID, it shouldn't make a difference. Do you know if you are root or non-root install?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that last part again? I missed it.
Sorry. Do you use root or non-root install? Is the application is?
It would be. I would think non-root, but I mean, there's still a lot that I need to learn. I was going to ask you for your best recommendation for someone kind of starting out. I mean, not completely starting out, but just I would like to know more about the application, and you know that. Dive into, you know, creating accounts more often and understanding the different options. So
to answer that, look at what we have at the university, university site. There are some basic free classes that will lead you through some things and explain some things. There are also actually a real good advanced routing class. But that's if you're going to do a lot of onboardings. But even with the free options, there is a few things that might be useful. And the other thing, we had increased a lot what we have. Okay, I stopped sharing. Hold on. We had added quite a lot of help pages all over the place. So, and I know they're not that helpful for the account itself, but when you start playing with subscriptions and routes, there is a lot more information both on the tooltip and in the help page. But if you're just starting again and you haven't done a lot of it, look through the free classes available from university, from Maxway University, because they explain the basics of fields and stuff like that here and there.
Okay, so you don't have one specific class in mind?
Not really.
Not really. Okay. All right.
As I said, start with the free classes because we have a few that are just recordings that you can listen to at any time for free. And if you want more, obviously we have the paid classes as well with a lot more detail.
Okay.
And a lot deeper. But at least to get you kick-started, they actually made some things available initially, the basic stuff.
Okay, cool.
And from there, it will really depend on what you will be doing on the server, right? If you're going to be the onboarding person, you know, all the routing and so on. As I said, the advanced routing class is actually very good for that because it will lead you through every single option of all kinds of things of what you can and cannot do and how you can think about advanced routing because it's a whole engine. It's a server inside of the server.
Is it? So. Okay. All right. I'll look for that.
Yeah. But again, if you're just going to do in and out, you know, file right, file left, you don't need that much stuff. If you're going to do conditional stuff and all kinds of interesting routing, that it might be worth it. So start with the free stuff, see where it leads you, and take it from there.
Okay, cool. Will do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hey, Annie. Oh. Joe here again. It's funny. I just did an upgrade this weekend from November 2021 to this February 23, and I'm now running into that same issue with when I change the account settings. Right, it says the current owner of the home folder does not match the file system owner, and it's a non-root. But the funny thing is, it's wrong. It's the owner, the UID and the GID and what the user password, it is what's listed under the account. So I guess that might be a feature, bug, whatever.
it might be just overzealous. So when they released the feature first, they made it send the pop-up on every single change, regardless if you change the UID, GID. Then we all rebelled and told them no. So they changed it to be only when something is changed and actually need to ask. So I'm not sure if you're caught in the middle of this conversion or if you hit the bug. I open a ticket to support, see what they will say. I just really don't remember when they changed it, but I remember that when they put it first, it was literally every time you edited an account, it will throw you. You're changing UID, GID. Okay. I'm not, but okay.
Yeah, I was just changing an email. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I was just changing an email on a phone on a couple of different accounts existing. And I hit it every time. So, all right, yeah. I'll open a ticket.
Yeah, you might, as I said, you might be in this case where we were warning everyone just to be. It was. Initially, we were doing it behind the scenes. People were not happy about that. So we decided to be all clear. And the way they were building that was every time when they will call the CHO behind the scenes, they would throw the warnings, and they were doing it way too often. So there was something happening. I just don't remember which release that was on.
Yeah, and I tried to update it. But it's a non-root, it didn't have the ability to update it, I guess.
No, when you're non-root, we cannot do CH own because we don't run as a super user, that Java itself. But it also doesn't matter what UID, GID you put. The UID becomes irrelevant. The GID can be used for user classes and from there for rules for access or whatever, right? But because you are non-root, it cannot touch the OS.
Right.
And you said you're on February, right?
Yep.
Is the UID GID of your users matching the UID GID on the file system?
Absolutely. Even on the root, on the mount.
Okay.
Right. It's right. So all the way back to the parent directory, and they're not nested. Each account has its own directory. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Check with support what you just might be into. We'll always warn you no matter what, because we're going to try that anyway, even if we cannot stage.
Yeah. I mean, we don't change email IDs and stuff like, so it's not a major issue. Just, I wonder why it's asking me. So great. Thanks.
The reason they were asking was because behind the scenes they were doing it before. So they just pushed it up, but didn't clean up the warning until a later version. And now in the May version, it's only warning you if it will actually do something.
Okie dokie. Thanks.
Yep. Okay. What else do we have?
Hey, Annie, I have a question.
Yep. Hey, Kamesh, go ahead.
Hey. We have a situation wherein there is files being pulled from SMB, but on the message tracker, at times we see a failure saying it's outbound transaction.
Okay. So what happens
we're not sure as why it's called. It's transpiring from inbound to outbound when it's actually inbound file for us.
Are you pulling from a subscription that is advanced routing?
Yes.
And if on this outbound, did you happen to look what the protocol is? Is it saying SMB or is it saying routing?
It says SMB.
Outbound SMB?
Yes.
That's surprising if my voice doesn't show you that. It shouldn't happen. So what I would expect to see will be inbound SMB followed by the routing lines, which can be inbound or outbound depending on what you're doing, or both sometimes. If you're seeing outbound SMB, that means we're trying to push to an SMB. Or, that's the only case I can think of when you're pushing to it.
Yeah, I'm just looking at my screen. It's the advanced route. What we have is that the subscription is trying to pull. It's an auto schedule, and it's trying to pull inbound files from SMB, and it's assigned to a route where it is being sent a copy to an archive location that we have, and another one is sending to an external trading partner over SSH.
Is the archive location SMB or is it just folder monitor?
It's just a folder monitor.
Okay.
It's S3. We are moving it to S3.
Okay, S3, okay. And you see an outbound SMB and not outbound S3 or outbound SSH?
No, we are having, say for example, on the first iteration, it tries to pull from the SMB. And it says the first line would say inbound, and the next line would say outbound failure on the same SMB. And after a while, we try for the triggering it. It goes through fine.
Okay. Do you have delete on success on the SMB when you're pulling from the SMB? Do you try to delete the file after you pull it?
Yeah. Let me check it right now.
Because
on a normal nomenclature here, we just follow to pick the files from the source and we delete those as soon as we have.
Okay. When this is successful, do you again see an outbound or do you just see the inbound?
On a success, we see only the inbound transaction. We don't see any outbound information.
Okay, I have a theory. It doesn't make sense. So the only thing I can think of is that on error, we're trying to do some cleanup and we're marking it at outbound for some reason, but we shouldn't. Oh, and it says SMB as a protocol, right?
Yes, it says SMB as protocol.
Yeah. I wonder, do you have on the subscription, on error, do you have a checkbox to delete the partial file?
No, we haven't enabled any such options.
Yeah. Okay. Because a deletion of a file will show up as outbound.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my theory that we might be trying
to that would be up. Based on the acknowledgement that we receive from the file system. So that would turn into outbound. I understand that part. But we haven't done anything partial file deletion, partial file upload deletion.
I don't know, Kamesh. Honestly, that doesn't make any sense. My gut feeling is that on error, we're doing something and something to clean up, and we're recording it weirdly. So if you have a live example, get support to look into the system to try to get to the bottom of it. It might end up being just weird recording, because the way the tracking table is written is basically just writes whenever there is the proper event for it, right? So in order to have an outbound, there should be an outbound event of some type or another. We are doing outbounds in two cases. When a file is leaving the system, you know, the standard download push, but also on local deletes. So
okay.
I'm wondering if it's not some... when that happened, is the size zero of the file on the outbound?
Just a moment.
Yeah. Because if it is a zero, it's much... although if it's an error, the other one is also zero. So that doesn't tell us anything. But yeah, you will need someone to actually look onto the system itself and look through the server logs and see what is happening. Because it almost sounds like either we're doing cleanup and we're reporting it weirdly, or something else is happening that converts it. It shouldn't be an outbound. You're too early for outbound.
It's loading up. Also,
yeah,
I have one another situation, Danny. Right now I just opened that SMB error that we have. It says outbound and it's the file size is 0 KB.
Yep. That might be a delete. If you click on it,
yeah.
So click on it, go to the bottom of the page. What is the error?
The error, it says connection to that server failed.
And that's outbound?
And on the outbound, it says error during transfer operation, the path and the file name, the file not found. And it says connection to server failed.
Okay. It doesn't make sense. So get support to look into that. Either we're coding weirdly or we're doing something very strange here that I'm not thinking of, but I cannot think of what.
Okay. Yeah.
Can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you using the shared file system on multiple servers?
It's an SMB location on our network.
No, account, user accounts, home folder. Is that a shared mount or local file system?
No, it's a file system, not a shared one.
Yeah, sometimes when we mistakenly give us a local system, we get a similar problem.
We're showing an outbound on the tracking.
But it should have been inbound instead of outbound. That is where we are.
Okay.
No, actually, Kamesh, Rao is right. If you're using if you are in a cluster with a local home folder, sometimes the server might get very confused because the file disappears midway. But still, it shouldn't be outbound. Anyway,
it shouldn't be
outbound. Okay. No. Let's get support to look into that, Kamesh. I'll be very curious to see what happens here. It might be something in the SMB itself. It might be something in your configuration that, you know, some of your error handling.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It just...
Okay.
It just doesn't belong to me, but... Okay.
Okay. Thank you. I have another situation also. And
sure.
User is downloading the file and it shows us outbound fail
mm-hmm.
on our end. Outbound user and it is over SSH and mm-hmm. it says file transaction has failed. And it says transaction aborted, that the transfer is aborted. But when I check with the user or to the vendor, they have closed the connection successfully and it is not showing any error on their end, but it says us outbound failed on our end.
Yeah, what client is the customer using? Do you know to connect?
They're using an application. They're using a single application. Cloud application.
They are not closing something properly. So SSH is very particular. SFTP is very particular on how things get closed. And if we don't receive the closing statement, we assume that something went wrong.
Okay, so it's not showing up on either cases. They're not able to see that error on their end. They see successful termination.
Because they close theirs because everything is okay, but they don't send the last package to tell us we got the file successfully. So we assume something went wrong. We're missing a package between the two of them. That's why my first question is, what software are they using? They're whatever they're using is either not configured properly to send things, or is if it is homegrown, they haven't built it based on the RFCs. But basically, okay. In the ST world, unless we receive the confirmation on whatever protocol it's appropriate, we're assuming something went wrong because we don't know if they received the whole file.
Okay.
So, it's on their side. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I was pretty sure it's on there, and we tried to justify that, but wherein we have been just getting this issue, and I just tried to reach out to customer support, access support as well, and they also did the same, mm-hmm. and they were able to provide us info as what needs to be done to see their logs to show up that it turns up to an outbound failure. Okay, I will go ahead and raise that incident for the other issue. And I'll try to touch base with you in the next session if you have any inputs on that.
Yep. That works for me. And I know we have a question in the chat, but Mark had his hand raised for a while.
Exactly.
So yep. I know. Mark, you're next. And then I'm going to catch up on the question in the chat by Michael. So, Mark? Mark? Mark Lee. You're muted. Okay, I don't know what's going on with Mark. Mark, whenever you're back or if you have trouble talking, put something in the chat so we know what's going on. In the meantime, let me see the question in the chat. Questions arriving over. Okay, the question from the chat. Files are arriving over SMB or folder monitor, but the outbounds are delayed with a lot, like 45 minutes delayed. Michael, I know your headset is not working, so here is where I would start looking. Make sure you don't have a very severe restriction on the SSH site itself on how many connections it can open. Because if you have already too many open connections, it might not be able to send through, and that's why they're delayed. And the other thing I would like to know is if it is only these files that are delayed or if there had been or if everything else was delayed at the same time. And I know you're chat only, So that might take a while to answer. So everything was delayed. Okay. If everything, so was there anything moving at all? Was, or was just the server receiving files and nothing was moving? Because there are two options here. Okay, so everything else was fine. So it's possible that, so someone will need to look into the what exactly was happening. One possibility was is that because there were so many files going to the same place, the few first 100 or so managed to open connections, but then for whatever reason, they stayed open for a very long time. So all everything else went on a timeout and waiting for them to finish. If especially if it was happening only with this SSH site, a single SSH site, it's also possible that the TM was just blinking, as I call it. Basically, because you had so much volume going through it, it was a little stuck, so it was clearing to its queues, but because there were so many files to move through, there were so many things that had to go into internal retry that it looked like it's not doing anything while it keep chugging to try to find the file that can leave the server. I don't know if that makes sense to some extent. It's, do you have enterprise cluster or standard cluster? Michael? Enterprise? Yeah, with enterprise. Honestly, without seeing your data, I don't want to talk too much about that, but my gut feeling is that because it was such a busy time, your server is not fully tuned properly. So for a little while there, it was actually struggling to stay up properly. Yep, and you went to tuning as well. Yeah, so the way enterprise cluster is working is that if it feels like it cannot handle jobs, it will just leave them into the database until it can stabilize itself. So if you are not tuned properly and all of your threads are busy and so on, it just doesn't have the capacity. Enterprise, so standard cluster, and that's why I asked, standard cluster will just crash one of the servers. The secondary will go down, or the primary will actually be usually first down. With enterprise cluster, the cluster will try to protect itself as much as it can, which sometimes means leaving the events into the database. So, and then we'll pick them up when it's stable enough. So I would say some tuning is in order on your servers, very heavy tuning. And we're not talking just memory and CPU at this point. We're talking about thread numbers. We're talking about all kinds of, you know, internal mechanics that we have so that you open it a little bit wider for cases like when that happened. It also, I was saying there is a few parameters about thread sizes and thread numbers for the transaction manager, for the event queue and so on. Those values might need adjusting a little bit. Unfortunately, outside of the capacity guide, we don't really have a this is the best value, go and use them. So it might be a little bit of a try, fail, try again kind of situation, hopefully without the fail in the middle. But we don't have a perfect numbers to give you because everyone is different. So if you had never done any tuning like that, run the numbers by support before you apply them on a live server, and obviously test on development server, of course. But that's the only thing I can think of. Either that or you hit a bug. So especially because SMB is involved, the plugin had a couple of problems in the past with not closing connections properly, which was causing this kind of a blips until they timed out. I don't think you're on the latest version of the plugin, right? Not just latest SD. And if you're on the latest, I haven't heard anyone complaining of it doing it again. But I would keep an eye on it. If it happens again with SMB specifically, get support to look into it. We might have missed something again there. But other from that, it's a little bit of a, it's hard to diagnose without looking at log files, obviously. But that's where I would start. Did all the files go out finally, even though they were delayed? Yep. Okay. Well, that's good news. That means the server recovered, which is what it was supposed to do. But I know that the delays are not nice. That's what it sounds to me like. Your server was a bit so overloaded. So one thing to check next time it happens. You know that we added the monitor for the event queue in the API. Look at how many events are in the event queue at the time when things are really slow. You probably will have a huge amount of events in there, which is not a problem on its own. You didn't. Okay, go to the API. Let's see if we can do that. Hold on. I have a live server. I keep forgetting that. Hold on. Too many windows. API. Did it kick me out? Not yet. So the bigger number of. So in here on the events, you can do a get that will get you the events. And let's see, limit 10, offset 0. See if I messed up something or not. So I don't have anything, obviously, but what it will give you is the total count. And this is actually the number we're looking for. So make a very small offset with a very offset 0 with a very small limit, just so you don't grab 1,000 events. You don't want that. But look at the number of the events. What it will tell you is how many things are actually scheduled to be processed. And again, that doesn't always denote an error. You can have in enterprise cluster, the biggest I've ever seen was about 50,000 and it was chugging just fine. But if you have a lot of them, especially if a lot of them are pulls from a single site, they will chug to them slowly. And the way it works is that the server will get to an event and say, oh, okay, you're a pull, but I already have 100 or whatever your maximum is. So I cannot take you. Go for internal retry, which will send it at the end of the queue. And so on and so forth. When the line is too big, we start getting back those that were from the back again to send them back over and over. Those internal retries don't count it as retries. So you can have thousands of them happening. And don't forget that it's not just the pulls themselves. The incoming ends might be also retrying if something is going weird or they might not be processing. So that's the best thing you can do at this point. You can look at the event queue. You can see what's going on. My guess is that on a very, if your server was, everything was waiting, it was basically that way. Another option, by the way, and it's specifically because you're coming from SMB and from external stores, look at the dates of those files. Is it possible that they were, that something on the drives was post-dating them, so they appeared files from the future? Because we'll pull them on an SMB, but once they arrive, we cannot process a future file. So if we keep the date of the file, who knows? So you have, if you have some date discrepancies between systems, that might cause troubles. And that's pretty much all I can think of. Okay. See, you talked about most of it. So at this point, some tuning, and next time it happens, Just look at the event queue, look at the server log, see what happens, if you can get support live on the system to look. But I would not restart the servers. Anytime you restart one of those servers when they're dead stuck, what it does is basically to flush the queue and start over to it, disrupting everything it had been doing. It's basically a balance. So what you did was just leaving it to run, and at the end all the files went out, is basically what it is designed to do. Stay up, handle as much as possible, as fast as possible. But that's, yeah, I know, everyone is tempted to restart. I can tell you, it will feel like it's helping because it will probably move about 5 files before it gets stuck again. And in the long run, something that would have taken an hour will take about 4 hours if you keep restarting it. So what I do with these kind of stuck servers, I'll just leave them for an hour to see what happens. Usually, and it sounds like it happened in your case, they will just solve themselves and start moving. But in all cases, make sure you save the logs from that. Even though it resolved itself, get the logs to support to see if they can figure out the root cause of that. Again, it might be just load, so you might need tuning, but it might be a bug somewhere or something else happening. You know, that's the best I can say without logs and without spending the next 3 hours reading log files. Okay, well, good. Okay, Mark, you back? Mark Lee? Nicole, can you try to unmute him? Maybe he cannot unmute.
Sure, let me try. I sent an email to Mark.
Okay. Oh, okay. While we're waiting for Mark. Did you lose him?
Huh?
He's still here. Hey. Mark? Yeah, his mic is disabled. Sorry, Ed, go ahead.
Hey, Eddie. I was just two other questions for me. On the containerization front, we were looking to obtain the Docker images last year, and they said that they weren't support said they weren't available yet. Are they still not available, or are they ready for public use yet? Do you know?
Well, that will be a two-pronged question. We do have some images at the moment. They're in restricted availability because they're still looking into them. But we gave up on the idea of making ST as it stands now container savvy.
Okay.
It just doesn't work, not with our type of databases. You know, think about how we connect, what we talked about earlier about databases. That's basically the antithesis of Dockerization, right?
Right.
So instead, they were working on something that will be called Secure Transport Docker Edition.
Okay.
Cloud Edition. Cloud Edition, which will basically be our container setup, which will be a different type of application. They are projecting first build late next year.
Okay.
So if you need something at the moment and you really, really need to go on containers, talk to your EA and let's see if we can get you the current array builds. But if you can wait and you really need to go to cloud, I would say to look for the cloud edition stuff. And they're already talking about stuff. They had a very good conversation and they had advisory board actually last week on the summit for that. And I expect some meetings very soon. And I'll remind them that Dell is interested again, because I know you are.
Yeah.
But we finally realized that what we were trying to do was to fit a very square application in a very round hole that was three sizes too small.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually sit back and thought about, okay, if we cannot get the monolith in, can we do something a little bit more intelligent?
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't that many details yet on that either. There are some.
Okay.
We know that the Cloud Edition ST behind the hood, it will be doing the same things, but the way it will be positioned and put on the servers will be different.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But for now, if you really, really need the images, talk to the AE or actually talk to support, see if we can get the GAs. But, you know, the arrays, there is no GAs. There won't be GAs on the current releases. So.
Okay, thanks. And then one other thing that, so we have a team that basically monitors our environment and you know, handles failures and things along those lines. And one of the topics that they asked us about was resubmitting failures. So if for example, right, we have a bunch of files going to a server that's down for whatever reason. And that server then gets brought up and we can resend the files. There's no way to like do like a bulk reprocessing.
Right? You can.
You can. How do you do?
APIs.
APIs, okay.
Yeah, but even on the API, it's restricted on how many can go in the same batch. It's basically trying to protect you from not shooting yourself in the foot. I think at the moment, the limit is 10. But basically, when you go to where I am, hold on, API, let me share again. So there are two separate resubmits. One is for a single file. You know, that's the one that everyone is usually using, or the one from the UI. It's basically the same one. It's right. My transfers. Hold on. Okay, I'm in the wrong place. Anyway, there are two resubmits. They might need to go to API 1.4. I don't remember the details off the top of my head. But basically, there are two separate resubmits in ST. That's...
Okay. So, but you said there's a limit of 10 you can do via the, okay.
Yeah, and then they can, and then this API has both limit and offset, so they can cycle through them very quickly, you know, write it on a script or something and go 0 to 10 to 9, 10 to 19, and so on, and they'll go. So.
Okay. All right, I'll look into that. Thank you.
Yeah, and the reason why, if you cannot find it in the 2.0, I think it was one of the ones that didn't make it into 2.0, but I haven't looked for a while. Look down on the 1.4 APIs.
1.4, okay.
Know, the old API. And that's basically, if you cannot find that something in the 2.0, sometimes it might be worth looking into the 1.4, mm-hmm. because some of the weird actions didn't make it up, and we had been tracking them. I don't really remember if it was in 2.0. I know it was not. So I know that when they released 2.0, only the small resubmit, as I call it, the single file resubmit was on the API. So we had to default on 1.4. I literally haven't looked for a year and a half at least to see if it made it into 2.0. I just put a note for myself. I'll check after the call because now I'm curious.
Sure.
But that's the best option. And the reason why we had to put the limit on how many files you can set at a time, let's just say that someone might have resubmitted 10 million files.
Mm-hmm.
That might have happened.
okay.
So we used to allow pretty much everything, but when we changed the resubmit to allow resubmitting successes as well, that's when we screwed up.
I see.
You know? Someone actually resubmitted their whole server. They had 10 million records in the tracking table. It was ugly.
yeah.
Very ugly. So that's why we have the limit. The other thing is, you know, the resubmit itself takes the same search parameters as the get. So they can do the get to search for them. And when they have their query properly set up, then they get use that for resubmits. You know, only errors, only to that server, all that funny stuff. Or alternatively, gotcha. They can just get the ideas and just use the API to cycle through them.
Okay.
Now, and here is my regular warning, because if you go to the API, please, please, please do session management. You know, log in once, use the same cookie, to send all the rest submits instead of opening a new connection with username password every time. You know, you know that. Everyone that had been on this call or know me on other things knows that I'm always nagging for that. And then send a logout just to clean up things a little bit. It's the admin UI. It's better than the HTTPD, but still, let's not clog the server with sessions that will never resolve. Right?
Right.
But yeah, that's what it is. So let them play. Of course, give them first a test server, please. Don't do that on the live server.
Right. Okay. Makes I'll sense? Check it out. Thanks. Yes. Thank you.
If you cannot find it, ping me. I'll track it down. I just don't want to spend the next 3 minutes trying to remember where it was. I know it's there because I've done that. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay. Good. Kamesh, that's you. We lost our other question. So go, Kamesh.
Thanks, Annie. Two questions I have. Is there any plans for a major upgrade from 5.5 to 5.6 in near future?
We're in continuous development, and the current statement is that we're on 5.5 continuously until we're not, which basically means no plans whatsoever, but we never know.
Okay. And the second question is, what can be the maximum concurrent connection that we can do for an SSH file transfer for external vendors?
That's a loaded question. Technically unlimited. In reality, if you need more than about 600 to 800 on an edge or server, I would strongly recommend you get another server or edge into the picture. So the way I'm planning for size is every 600 to 800 connections require a separate edge.
Okay. Yeah, right now we have 500. We are good for that. But on the subscription, what would be the maximum concurrent connection we can do on the subscription? Say, for example, on the panel connections.
On the subscription, you cannot go 100 higher than 100 because we already have a hard-coded max connection per host. So we cannot open more than 100 connection to a single host name to start with. So a single transfer site, even if it is the only the same, if it is the only one on test host name, cannot blow through that. You know, you have three separate levels for that. You have the on the site itself, on the subscription for pools, and you have the max, which is the global setting, the max per host. The smallest of those will restrict everything. So no matter how high you go on the site itself, it can never blow through the other two, so under 100.
Okay. We have a situation wherein some vendors do have only the maximum concurrent connection that we could do is 10. So we are limiting ourselves to do the subscription for that at 10. But still, say, for example, if we have 11 files or the 10 files, at times the 9 files go through one file phase. So
yeah. So if you have 10 connections, set the value to 9. Let ST make a mistake. Because we have so many concurrent connections, I would always account to 10 to 20% chance of us blowing through the numbers. So if they allow 10, I would put either 8 or 9 in the field just to be on the safe side.
Good, thank you. So I did that same right now to have that to go through. I made it 8 for 10 against whatever they have given. Okay.
Yeah. So just a little lower, you know, because we're doing calculations and we have a lot of things going in parallel, and especially when you have a lot of small files or when we're pooling, there is a huge amount of events that literally ping the same time. So if you have three pool files in three separate threads at the same time checking, is there a connection for me? Chances are two of them will step on each other's toes. We're trying to resolve it in a lot of ways, but plus one, plus two, you know, 10, 20%, on the smaller values especially, it's inevitable. So I would do minus two if you can. I mean, they won't move that fast anyway. So.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, so that's what's
it basically, you had two files in parallel asking, am I good to go? And they were literally in parallel. That's the problem with multi-threaded systems, right? We're a lot better than we used to be, that I can tell you. Especially now we're up in the coherence layer and not locally on the servers, but still it can get a little slower. So that's what you need to do. Just go a little lower. Another thing, Kamesh, by the way, you might want to put the setting on both the site and the subscription. So both of them can enforce each other. So even if one of the checks fails, the other one might catch up.
You mean to say that on the transfer side?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, on sure. Yeah.
Top of the transfer side, you can put the same number over there that you have on the subscription. Technically, it sounds like double dipping, you know, putting the same setting in both places. But in practice, because of timing consideration, it's possible that one of them get checked faster or, you know, you're beating a parallel action.
And okay, right.
That's what's going on. And sometimes we just, no matter how many times we lock and so on, we either need to slow down everything or we can just account for a little bit of a differential. And yeah, that's why I keep a little lower. That's all. Okay, good. We're almost perfect. Okay, we have 10 more minutes. So we have time for about two more questions, maybe. Anything else? Anyone else?
Annie, Mark replied, it was an error. You apologize.
That's okay. Okay. Anyone else? Last call for questions until 6 weeks from now or thereabouts. If not, couple of housekeeping items while I have everyone. So as you know, we just had our summit last week. It went very well, as some of the people on the call that were also in the room will tell you. I actually did a presentation of very interesting ways of how to use ST smarter. We were thinking of doing them piecemeal on these meetings. Instead, there will be another user group in a few weeks called Smarter Secure Transport. And I'll just have the presentation from the summit. It's basically advanced routing trickery and fun stuff with advanced routing. So if you see that one, that's what this is all about. Okay, last call for questions.
Hi, Annie. This is Paula Zubak with Chubb. Can you just tell us again where the free training is?
Oh, go to Axway University.
Okay.
And you should see listed whatever is available. And I actually have the trainer on the phone at the moment. So, Ian?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact link. I can send it to you and put a chat. But there should be a learning path, and that will give you all the free courses in there.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. So Ian Percival is a person responsible for all the secure transport training. So that's why he joined our meeting, in case we have questions about university. And see, we had. So yes, they built the learning paths that should help you. Okay, we have a question in the chat. How to add archival files to separate paths on different file system? Yeah. I'm not going to try to pronounce your name. Vishnudas, something like that. I'm sorry. I'm bad with names. You cannot do it with the archiving itself. So you cannot do it on the subscription level. What you will need to do is to create a folder monitor site that points to the other location and basically do an outbound transfer, push the file into the system at the end of your route. So instead of making it an archive on the subscription page, you just add a last step inside of the routing itself, which is to push to the folder monitor. And then on the push itself, on the send to partner, you can change the upload path to put it wherever you want it to go. Another option, if you don't want to do a push to a folder monitor, is to create a special ST account for archiving and put the archiving location as the home folder of this account. And then you do the same as the send to parkmart, is that you publish to account and you publish to whatever folder of that account. Publish to account might be better in some cases because it can create folders for you when you drop the file and so on. But it will also create the .stfs folders on the receiving side. If you don't mind them, then you're good to go.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, it's not straightforward, and but it's cleaner. It will also show up in your tracking table, so you have better control. I personally like using the publish to account for two reasons. One of them is it doesn't count as a transfer, outbound transfer for the license, for the count of subscriptions, but also because it can create the folders for you. And you also can choose what to happen if this file already exists. So if you're trying to archive the same file, you can actually put a timestamp, or, you know, you can make sure both of them survive and so on. But you need to deal with the .stfs folders. So, you know, because it's a home folder, right? But that's pretty much it. And Ian has the link for the base for the training in the chat window for anyone that needs it. But if you don't catch it from there, university.taxway.com, look for the learning paths or learning plans, and we have things there. Okay. Any other questions? Anyone? We're almost on time. We have 5 minutes left. If no one has anything, thanks everyone for joining us this morning, afternoon, whatever time it is, wherever you are. And I have one
final question. So you said that you're going to send us the link for the recording. So how do we access that recording?
That's for this meeting. That's what Nicole will tell you in a second. That's her.
Okay.
I talk and I answer questions. She's doing all the stuff around it, organizing, sending links, and telling you what's next. And again, as I said, there will be also another one we'll